From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, filling in for the vacationing Terry Gross. On today's show, I'll speak with singer Barbara Cook. In the 50s and 60s, she was a Broadway leading lady, stealing the show in productions of The Music Man, Plain and Fancy, and Candide. But as Broadway waned, so did her singing career. Now she's a star in cabarets and concert halls. Also today, I'll talk with Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar. Folk singer Michael Cooney will play two songs, including the Cole Porter classic, Miss Otis Regrets. And critic at large, Laurie Stone, will discuss the twin sides of comic Judy Tenuta. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is singer Barbara Cook. During the 1950s and 60s, she was the most celebrated ingenue on the Broadway musical stage. She won a Tony Award for her performance as Marion the Librarian in the original production of The Music Man, but also stole the show and won rave reviews for her performances in Candide, Plain and Fancy, Carousel, and She Loves Me. Broadway's Barbara Cook then disappeared for several years, only to reemerge as a cabaret and concert singer. She made her Carnegie Hall debut in 1975 and went on to national and international acclaim. In 1985, she appeared with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra as Sally in the concert version of Stephen Sondheim's Follies. This year, she brought her own concert for the theater from London back to Broadway's Ambassador Theater. But all of this is only background information. As for her voice, all you have to do is listen. To steal a quote from the liner notes on the back of her As of Today album, "If I ever get to heaven and the angels don't all sound like Barbara Cook, God's going to have a lot to answer for." Barbara Cook, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's a real treat to have you here. I'm going to start with a song from your It's Better With a Band album. It's a song that was written by your musical director, Wally Harper, and David Zippel. It's called The Ingenue. But before we hear it, I think we need to hear a little bit about how this song came to be written.
Well, I think it's a song. David Zippel wrote the words and Wally Harper wrote the music. I think it's a song that David had been thinking about writing. It started as a poem, actually. He brought it over to me and asked if I liked it, and I did, and Wally set it to music. I had about, I guess, 5 days to learn this for the concert, and that's really enough time, I suppose, except that when you're under that kind of pressure recording it and performing it for the first time, I was terrified. I kept the words on the piano just in case I forgot, and I did make one little bubble in there.
I'm sure it probably wasn't even noticed. It's such a fun song. It really pokes fun at your the early image that everybody had of you, didn't it?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I never did really think of myself as the quintessential ingenue anyway. So many of the roles I played were not actually ingenue roles. They were, for instance, in The Music Man, this woman is in her 30s and her late 30s, and her mother is afraid she's going to become a spinster. And Cunegonda is like a cartoon.
That's in Candide, the character in Candide.
Yes, is a kind of cartoon of an ingenue. And in Oklahoma and Carousel, I played the soubrette comedy roles rather than the leading lady roles, although I did at one point go on to play the leading lady Julie in Carousel. Mm-hmm. So that very often I didn't play the ingenue roles, and I suppose the reason people think of me as the typical ingenue is the way I look and sound. But actually the roles I played were very often not those roles at all.
Mm, that's very interesting. Let's hear the song.
For quite some time I've heard that I'm alleged to be an ingenue. And yes, it's true, when I was 2 I pledged to be an ingenue. My agent said before I went to do what Doris Day would do and sign up on the dotted line if William Morris Pay would do.
William Morris Pay would do.
When I was 3 three, they said to me the stage would be my medium. But ingenues must pay their dues with unrelenting tedium. We must be sweet or quite discreet and dress in unappealing clothes. We may not tease our friends or hair, or swear or wear revealing clothes. One has to fear the casting couch producers, lust and greed alike. They let you like, covet you like, their hairlines all recede alike. They scream a lot and scheme a lot, and even David Miracle be calm at first, but in a burst get totally hysterical. An ingenue must promise to imprison her virginity. All men above the age of 10 are kept from her vicinity. A lady's reputation is unlikely to improve at all. A stain on that, no laundromat or cleaner can remove at all. The parts you play quite often may require you to ham a lot, and you're in quite time to wind up in a bus and truck of Camelot. The parts for boys you play against, they bring out all the clones to do, and movie roles you live to play, they give to Shirley Jones to do. For many shows the actress knows the critics will attack her in. It's so hard to live on guard and stay as sweet as saccharin. Add up all the pros and cons, you'll end up with a minus score. And that is why the ingenue has died out like the dinosaur.
That's the song The Ingenue from the album It's Better With a Band, recorded by my guest Barbara Cook, who's speaking to us from the studios of National Public Radio in New York. Shirley Jones did get the movie role, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Were you a little devastated by that? Did you really want it?
Oh, sure I did. It was very hard at the time. I did two tests, actually. I was out there, and Teak DaCosta, who directed both the Broadway show and the film, was not satisfied with the first one, and so I did a second one. I certainly can't say I didn't have an opportunity, but it just didn't work out.
That was also a time, too, when whenever they transferred a Broadway musical to the movie, they invariably would find a movie star to do it.
Well, certainly that often would happen, yes.
In 1957, you did win the Tony Award for portraying Marion the Librarian in The Music Man.
Yes.
Was that a really heady time for you? Did you get good tables in restaurants and celebrities flocking to your dressing room?
Yes and no. All that time is kind of hazy to me. I felt so, I don't know, I think, unfortunately, I didn't fully enjoy that as much as I should have. I tell so many of my friends now who are experiencing a certain amount of success to really try to take it in. I don't know. I think I felt guilty about all of the things that were happening, and so I acted as if they weren't happening. It was, I try very, very much not to do that anymore.
You do tell a story in your concert about how you got to meet, well, it was Gary Cooper, Marlena Dietrich.
Yes.
Could you share
Dorothy
that?
Dorothy L'Amour.
Yeah. Would you share one of those stories with us?
Well, who should I talk about? Gary Cooper?
Oh, why not? Sure.
Well, Bob Preston used to come into my dressing room almost every evening when I was finishing my makeup, and we'd chat about the day. And one evening he told me that, what he said was, Coop's out front. And I'd never heard him call that, so I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, Barbara, Gary Cooper's out front. I said, listen, Bob, I want to tell you something. If I don't get to meet Gary Cooper, you just might as well not come in tomorrow night. So at the end of the performance, I hear this knock on my door, and there he was. He was, without any question, the most handsome man I've ever seen in my life. He was so tall, and he was so tan. So I said, Mr. Cooper, I'm so happy to meet you. And he said, gosh. He just looked down with those beautiful eyes and said, gosh, well, really.
You were melting.
He was really, what an impressive looking man he was.
Did you ask for his autograph?
No, I didn't. come to think of it. I never thought about that until right this minute. No, I didn't. I'm sorry I didn't.
No. You grew up in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Did you always want to be a singer, taking singing lessons and all that sort of familiar route?
Well, yes, except for those times when I wanted to be an airline stewardess or a nurse, which is what little girls aspired to in those days. I can remember very well when I was certainly probably no more than 3 or 4. I have very early memories. And I remember being taken to some sort of stage show with my mother and father. And I was dancing around the room when I came home and singing and pretending to be all of the people I'd seen. And I wanted very much to be up on the stage. I remember that. Very, very young memory.
You also tell a story in your concert about seeing Jeanette MacDonald in the movies.
Oh, God. You know, I wanted to be her. I wanted to be both of them. I wanted to be her. I wanted to be Nelson. I even once had a dream about meeting her. I never did meet her, actually. But I had a dream about having met her at the Russian Tea Room. And this is when I was an adult. And the dream was so real to me that I started telling my friends that I had met her because I honestly believed that I had. And I believed that for several years until I came across some sort of theater book I was reading, and in it was the date of her death. And I realized, because in my dream I had been with certain people who I hadn't met until after her death, that it was impossible. And then I called two of the other people in the dream and realized that I had been acting on this dream for several years. I mean, I absolutely, it is mad, let's face it, folks.
I think it's pretty normal, actually.
God, well, I dreamt I met her in the Russian Tea Room with Agnes DeMille. I'd worked with Agnes, so I know Agnes, and in my dream I went over and asked her to introduce me. Agnes said, Barbara, she said, you never met Agnes DeMille. I mean, she said, you never met Jeanette MacDonald. I never met Jeanette MacDonald.
Her movies were always so strange. I mean, she would, you know, kind of open up the window and start to sing, and, you know, all the townspeople would kind of gather underneath the window and sing along with her. And the orchestra, I had no idea where the orchestra ever came from in any of those movies.
No, wasn't it wonderful in those movies? They did, all of a sudden you have a 100-piece orchestra out of nowhere.
You also did some straight acting, which is
yes.
Something that I didn't realize. You were in the original production of Little Murders. You mm-hmm. replaced Sandy Dennis in Any Wednesday.
Right.
Were you trying to escape musicals at that time?
No, not particularly. I just wanted, it was something I wanted to do. I still would like to do a play. I would rather do a book show. I'm really looking for something to do on Broadway. I would like very much to do another show.
You left for a long time. You disappeared. No one had really was hearing from you, singing or otherwise. Why did you do that?
Well, actually, let me correct that a little bit, because I didn't disappear exactly.
Uh-huh.
I just, there was a 5-year period when I didn't sing in New York. I did do some plays during that time. I did some work with the Lincoln Center rep, and I did work out of town. But certainly, I didn't do anywhere near the amount or the kind of work that I had been doing for a number of years. There are several reasons. One is that I was getting older and needed to sort of get my ducks in a different row, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
And the theater was going through one of its lulls that it goes through every now and then. So there were fewer things available. And the other thing is that I think I needed to not work for a while. I needed to get some distance from my work, and I needed to, how can I put this? I needed to find out things about myself. I needed to change and grow and mature in a way. And I needed to get distance to do that.
You had talked before about feeling guilty about your success. I think it's something that we all feel sometimes when we have this incredible success, and it's, you feel like, I'm a fake, I'm going to get found out any minute now.
Yeah, it's a very common thing
to do.
I wasn't aware of it so much at the time. I just remember feeling that, We played at the Winter Garden, for instance, with Plain and Fancy. And that huge billboard that's over the Winter Garden Theater. Mm. My picture was up there with Cheryl Conway, who was also in the show. And that's sort of the kind of dream one would have, you know, when you're starting out and you first come to New York, you think, oh, God, you know, if you see a sign like that, you think, gee whiz, wouldn't it be great if one of these days my picture was up there and all that sort of thing. But when it happened, it was just, you know, there's my picture was up there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's success isn't quite what you expect it to be very often. It is only what it is. So that little by little, I think I've come to see that the process is the thing. And I just feel, oh, so fortunate. I can't tell you how fortunate I feel to be at my age and a woman, too. It's, you know, it ain't easy, is it?
No.
And to have not only survived, but to have more than survived in this business, I really thank my lucky stars very, very often.
My guest is Barbara Cook. She is a singer. She has recorded albums. She has been in Broadway musicals. She has sung with major orchestras. We're going to talk about her debut at Carnegie Hall back in 1975. After we take this short break, this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Barbara Cook. In 1957, she won the Tony Award for her portrayal of Marion the Librarian in The Music Man, and 30 years later, her Broadway show, Barbara Cook, A Concert for the Theater, was also nominated for a Tony Award.
No, it wasn't.
It was for Best One Man?
No, it wasn't nominated. Actually, I did win the Drama Desk Award.
You did win the Drama Desk Award?
Yes, but it was not nominated for Tony.
Oh, I swear that I saw it for Best...
I'm glad you think so.
I wanted you to get it so badly that that I put it in there.
That's very sweet of
you. Please, pardon my error. When you did finally come back to New York and you were singing and you started in cabarets and then... You made your debut at Carnegie Hall in 1975. You were heavier. Your physical image had changed. Was that hard, knowing that maybe the first thing that people were going to see about you was the way you looked?
Yeah, it was pretty difficult. It was very difficult. And I must say, there was a great deal of publicity around that time. You know, it's like I was discovered all over again. Which is really kind of silly, but that's the way it works, isn't it?
I think Newsweek called you an overnight star, right?
No, it's just, it's absurd. But it was difficult, yeah, sure. Mm. But I needed to work, and I needed to really get out and do things again.
We have a recording from that debut. It is from an album, Barbara Cook, at Carnegie Hall, and it's a song that I think you have to sing every time you you do perform in concert. It's called Dear Friend and Ice Cream.
Dear Friend, I am so sorry about last night. It was a nightmare in every way, but together you and I will laugh at last night someday. Ice cream, he brought me ice cream, vanilla ice cream. Simply stunned. The wonders never cease. It's been a most most peculiar day. Will wonders never cease? Will wonders never cease? Oh, where was I? I am so sorry about last night. It was a nightmare anyway, but together you and I will live last night someday. I sat there waiting in that cafe and never guessing that you were fat. That you were near. You were outside looking bold. Oh, my. Dear friend, I am so sorry about last night. Last night, I was so nasty. Well, he deserved it, but even so, that George is not like this George. This is a new George that I don't know. A man I love. It's almost like a dream, and strange as it may seem, who came to offer me Manila.
From the album Barbara Cook at Carnegie Hall, a song from She Loves Me. I want to be accurate this time, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
When I saw you do the show in London for the first time, it was in a very small fringe theater. You did this song almost as an afterthought. It was the crowd wanted you to do an encore, and everyone was yelling, ice cream, ice cream. Do you sort of feel an obligation to do these Broadway show tunes?
I resist doing them, not ice cream so much, because that's one that people really do seem to want me to do all the time. But the others I do generally resist doing somewhat, because, how can I put it? So many of them have their roots in operetta, so that they are singy. You have to really sort of sing out Louise. And I'm inclined to not want to do that as much as I would rather have a song that I can interpret more.
One that we don't associate then with a character, in other words.
Not that necessarily. It's very hard to describe. You just have to sing too hard with some of those things.
Oh, I see. It's laziness. No.
Yeah. It's basic lazy.
In the concert for the theater, which eventually did make it to Broadway, you did do something that did surprise me, as far as this whole sing out Louise routine is concerned. You put down the microphone and you sang Why Did I Choose You without one.
Yeah.
Just to prove that you could still do it?
No, it makes a nice moment to do that, you know?
And I'm reaching the balconies.
Well, it forces people to listen even more. It forces them to. So that you have that extra chance of communicating.
Mm-hmm. You do that in these shows. Even in a big theater, you have this ability to make me feel as though you're singing only to me, even if I'm way up in heaven, you know, in the in the last row of
oh, that's nice. Thank you. A lot of people say that. Thanks very much.
Are you singing to one person? We've been told about that in radio, is we're talking to masses of people, but if you pretend you're talking to one person, you tend to reach everybody.
I'm not usually conscious of doing that, but I do hate it when I'm in a theater and the lights are set up and the structure of the theater is such that I can't see people's faces at all. If I can't see a few people, I just hate it. It's very hard. It's like trying to have a conversation. It would be easier, for instance, if we were actually seeing each other, you know.
Yes.
there's all sorts of body language, you know, that you get. And I don't know. It's very hard, I think, to sing to just a big black expanse. I would much rather be able to see people. And occasionally I will address a line to a person. I don't do it very often because I think that embarrasses people very often, and they're afraid that I'm going to pull them into the evening in a way that that they would not like. So I don't like to do that too much because I don't want to create anxiety in the listener, you know.
You did a concert version of Follies, Stephen Sondheim's Follies. How did that happen? How were you approached to do that part?
It was Stephen's idea for me to do it. And I knew about it at least a year, I guess, before we did the concerts. I had no idea, and as I think most of us had no idea, that that it would turn out to be such an event. It was really extraordinary.
It was the album won a Grammy Award. I know a few sound engineers, and I was hearing from them that your voice was the only one that made them, you know, sort of stop cold and listen to what was going on instead of, you know, fiddling with their knobs and sitting there bored and,
that's,
you know,
nice,
reading magazines. The show that you brought to Broadway, Concert for a Theater, when you started out in the small theater in London, had you intended to bring it back?
No, not at all. We'd been working on several different ideas, several different ways of trying to present a musical evening. Even before Lena Horne did her show, we had been talking about it and trying to find a way to do it. At first we thought, well, maybe I should do it with another person, and it had several forms. And we just kept not feeling that it was right, and when we went to London to do our, actually we just went to do the act, we were at the point with the show where we thought we just didn't know where to head. We didn't know what to do next, so it was just sort of sitting around, lying fallow, had been for a few months. And then the reaction when we opened at the Donmar was so extraordinary that we did begin to think, well, perhaps we could do this, something simpler than we had originally expected that we would have to do for Broadway. And then when we moved from the Donmar into the Albury, we made a conscious effort to add theater songs and to add a little talk and to try to make it more of a theater evening than we had had at the Donmar. And when that was received as well as it was, we thought, well, you know, maybe we have been trying to gussy this thing up more than we need to, and perhaps it would work if we just, in New York, if we just do this very simple kind of evening. And otherwise, I think there's no way, if we hadn't done this in London, there's no way I would have had the courage to present anything as simple as that for Broadway.
And you got wonderful reviews, and
mostly they were quite good. There were some that were not.
But I saw the show, and I thought it was wonderful. And
thanks.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you very much.
Our time is up already.
Yes, our time is up. Thank you very much, Barbara
You're
Cook,
welcome.
For joining us. Barbara Cook has been my guest. Her singing career has taken her from the Broadway stage to the concert hall and back again. Her concert for the theater was performed this spring at the Ambassador Theater in New York City. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross returns from her vacation on the next edition of Fresh Air, and she will speak with Alexander Slepak. He was a Jewish refusnik in the Soviet Union and is now trying to get permission for his parents to leave that country. So I hope you'll tune in.
I like to sing, but it's better with a band. I like to play the piano, but it's better with a grand. Ask any bass or soprano from the Met to Dixieland. Singing may be swinging, but baby, it's better with a band. Give me a bass, that's a perfect place to start. Drama with rhythm, and you're sure to reach my heart. Perhaps a touch of percussion, now we're getting close to art. Singing may be swinging, but baby, it's better with a band.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for the vacationing Terry Gross. Coming up, I'll speak with the king of the surf guitar, Dick Dale. With the resurgence of the surfing scene, this 50-year-old's hard-driving guitar riffs are back in vogue. Also, folk singer Michael Cooney will play two songs, one a Cole Porter classic. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone will discuss how the stand-up comic Judy Tenuta neutralizes her own acidic wit. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. We have another visit now from one of our favorite summertime musical companions, folk singer Michael Cooney. Most of the time, you'll find Cooney on the road, playing for traditional and folk music fans all over the country. He travels light, driving around in an old van full of instruments and a few of life's necessities. But in his head, he carries hundreds of songs, tunes he's found on old records, dusty sheet music, and picked up from fellow musicians. Michael Cooney never stops looking for more songs to add to his collection.
Someday I'm going to learn a whole raft of sugar songs like I Like to Call Her My Sugar, and When I Take My Sugar to Tea, and I Left My Sugar Standing in the Rain and My Sugar Melted Away. And a friend of mine says, if you learn those, you have to learn Sweet Substitute. But I already know my favorite of all of them. My sugar is so refined. She's one of them high-class kind. She never wears a hat. She wears a chapeau. She goes to see the cinema, but never the show. My sugar is so refined. She's one of them high-class kind. She never buys a dress, always a frock. She always winds her timepiece up, but never her clock. She says tomato instead of tomato. She says potato instead of potato. And you should see how she holds her cup of tea. With just two fingers, well, she sticks out three. My sugar is so refined. She's one of them high-class kind. She never shares a kiss. She lets our lips unite. But oh, it feels like kissing, and each kiss is dynamite. I wonder what she thinks about each time I hold her tight. Oh, she's so refined. My sugar is real refined. Got the finest kind of mind. She never has a meal. She dines or sups. And dogs are little canine friends. They're never just pups. My sugar is so refined. She's one of them high-class kind. She never says goodbye. She says farewell. She always says magnificent. She never says swell. She says banana instead of banana. She says piano instead of piano. And you should see how she sits on her settee. Cake and coffee balanced on one knee. My sugar is so refined. She's one of them high-class kind. She acts just like her name is Mrs. Vanderloon. And oh, I love her so. And She will be married soon. I wonder what she'll do when we are on our honeymoon. Oh, she's so refined. Now here's one that seems to go with that one. This is an old Cole Porter song. Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. She's sorry to be delayed, but last evening down in Lover's Lane she strayed. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. When she awoke and found her dream of love had flown away. Madam, she ran to the man who had led her so far astray. From underneath her velvet gown, she drew a gun, shot her lover down. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. Mob came and got her, dragged her from the jail. Madam, they strung her up on a willow across the way. A moment before she died, raised up her pretty head and cried, Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today.
Folk singer Michael Cooney. He'll return with more tunes on future programs. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air.
One, two, three, four!
My guest can be seen in the new movie Back to the Beach, in the club scene playing a mean guitar. For 25 years, he's been the king of the surf guitar. His name is Dick Dale. Dick Dale is in his 50s now, gaining new audiences with his pounding rhythmic guitar music. When he spoke to us from the studios of KLON in Long Beach, California, the one thing I wanted to know was what came first, surfing or playing the guitar?
Well, playing the guitar did, of course. Do you want me to tell you why?
Yes.
Why? Well, it's because when I first started, it was I was in Massachusetts, and there was no surf. But I, you know, my first roots were guys like Hank Williams was country music, because I've always been a kind of an emotional type of a person. You know, I cried when I saw Bambi. You know, it's one of those things. And I love to sing, I Lost My Baby. You know, and so Hank Williams was very big to me.
It's been said that you can hear the ocean when you hold a shell up to your ear. But with your music, it's almost as though, you know, you can feel the waves. How do you do that?
Leanne, music is an attitude. When I play, I don't play like an accomplished, fine musician who is so intricate in what they do. Is like one who turns around and picks up an instrument and practices scales. I had more of a physical way of performing. My guitar is an extension of my, all the way from my abdomen, you might say, from the inside guts of me. So when I'm performing on, like when I'm out in the ocean and I'm coming across the face of a wave and I feel the rumbling coming over the top of my head and I'm coming down off the lip, off the top, and then you can hear the rumbling in the bottom when you're making bottom turns, like, to me it was like a great big sound, and I wanted to capture that on the bottom with my bottom strings. And on the highs, it'd be like, I like to stick my finger in the wall, you know, come across a wall, and all of a sudden the lip of the wave would come over the top of me, and it makes like a tss noise. So I would get that high, you know, on the high strings.
It is very jungle rhythm sort
yes.
of oriented as well. I mean, bop, 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 bop.
I patterned my original thumping style from people like Gene Krupa, like on the drums, who studied the native rhythms. You know, once again, music is an attitude. It's a sensual. It's a drive. Here's an example. If you take a bass player and you tell them to play a bass riff, most people want to kind of show off and show what they know. But the real strong people will go boom boom bum boom 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 bum boom 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 bum like that. Now the minute you go boom boom bum boom 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 bum boom boom bum boom 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 boom, you lose that the attention of a human. You know, like through hypnosis. That's why hypnotists speak with a straight sound. They never go high or all around. So my music has always been a driving bottom force. I've never left that.
Is it true you were the first rock and roll performer? I mean, I don't want to call you a rock and roll performer because that puts you in a label, but to perform on Ed Sullivan.
Yes, yes. You can say rock and roll. In fact, guys like Hendrix, the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, all these guys used to come to my dances and look up at me. People think surfing music started, you know, in the 60s. It didn't. I created it in 1957, 58. And people were coming to see me at a place called the Rendezvous Ballroom, 4,000 kids a night. It started with 17 surfers. And I just stood up on the stage, and one thing I can say, I was never a product of hype. People like Ed Sullivan and Life Magazine and all these people came to us. They knocked on our door because they heard about this one guy standing on stage, and it was 4,000 kids coming tonight with stomping in their feet.
approach to do the movie? Back to the Beach. Were you eager to do this?
First of all, I've been close with Annie and her family for years, ever since the original Beach Party movies.
This is Annette. Yes.
We knew that was in the making. We knew it was trying to get financed for a few years prior to that. And I just sat back, and Annie says, Dick, you know, I want to make sure that you're in this thing. I said, well, whatever floats your boat, sweetheart. You know, if you want it, I'll be there. If you need me, I'll be there. When the time came, I asked them what it was going to be like. And when I read the script, it was such a neat movie, I was just cracking up.
Listen, in the movie, you wear this incredible, wonderful, electric blue suit. Did you get to keep it?
No. Listen to this. When I get on stage, it's either in shorts and my little whatever I'm into, but mainly my cowboy boots and on black pants and a black, used to be a long sleeve satin jacket or a sleeveless jacket that has zippers on it. And that's what I usually wear on stage and because I sweat profusely when I'm working and it's like a madhouse up there. So all of a sudden when I go into the movie, I says, well, here's what I wear on stage. And he says, no, that's black. He says, you know, black's the bad guys, you know. And he says, we got to have you in some neat color because that's the good guys. So I says, oh, Lord. So what happened was they says, here's what you're going to wear. This is from London. And they show me this pink, this bright pink suit, silk, pure silk suit. I looked at that and I said, my mother's not going to even let me in the house when she sees that. But then when I looked at it, it was just beautiful. I mean, it was beautiful, and here's me, an old biker, you know, saying I'm going to wear a pink suit. So anyway, and then they showed me a blue suit, so they say you're going to wear both of these in the movie.
Are you still going to keep making what can be called surf music? Do you want to do something else?
I do what I want to do when I want to do it. But when I rip on my guitar with the guys like Van Halen, and I mean, to me, it's a compliment for them to say, God, we'd love to play with Dick. To me, that's a compliment. And as far as I'm concerned, I'll never be the technical musician as far as they are. I just as soon live on my reputation. What they don't know ain't going to never hurt them. But the thing is, I'll get up there and do what I do, and I play from my heart. So I tell the kids, it isn't how many notes you play, it's what you play. If it's one note, play it with your heart and soul.
Dick Dale, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Hey, it's a blast. Leanne, thank you. Remember, surf's up. The surf is always up.
Dick Dale can be seen and heard in the new movie Back to the Beach, where he performs the song Pipeline with Stevie Ray Vaughan. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who is co-hosting the program, joins us from Washington. Hi, John.
Happy Friday, Leanne.
Oh, thank you very much, John. What stories do you have today?
Well, Central American foreign ministers are meeting down in El Salvador, and they're trying to work out some of the details of advancing the Central American peace plan. We're going to have a report from Tom Gelton. Also, in the course of finding out how to cure AIDS, we need to know where it came from, and we have a piece on the myths debunked. Where did AIDS not come from? That's tonight. Also, we look at the 100 best albums, according to Rolling Stone, of the last 20 years and find out if we own any of those albums.
Do you own any of the albums?
You'll find out.
I guess I will. Thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered on National Public Radio. Judy Tenuta is a tiny woman who carries an accordion on stage. She's currently making a big splash on the stand-up comedy circuit, and our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has these thoughts on her performance.
I saw Judy Tenuta a few weeks ago at Caroline's Comedy Club in New York, and I laughed at her lacerating cuts. Nancy Reagan, tell me this broad doesn't eat 5 cakes and stuff a fist down her throat, Tenuta growled. It was perfect. Covert operations, secret barfing. You may have seen Tenuta, who's gathering a broad following. She comes on stage carrying an accordion, and she wears 50s prom dresses. Her delivery is slow burn, her voice gruff Cookie Monster. She had a shot on David Letterman's show and a featured part on HBO's Women of the Night. An album has just come out, and she's currently playing across the country with George Carlin. Elvis lives in me, she declares, shifting into Linda Blair mode. The king gives me orders. He wants a lot of banana sandwiches. Presley's singing she can take. It's Yoko's vocals she'd like to lose. If that guy had just aimed a little to the left, she raises an eyebrow. You thought it. I said it. Men don't inspire tenderness in her. One guy shakes his head and hisses, Mommy, Mommy. Sure, Tenuta retorts, like I'm gonna get hot for a cobra with a green card. Another sport wiggles a single forehead-spanning eyebrow, shoots a look that says, I'm God's gift to women, and grunts, What do you say we go out? She replies, I was looking for someone closer to the top of the food chain. Tenuta's strength comes from playing no man's fool, but unfortunately it's not a secure position. She doesn't stand squarely inside her funny, likable character, this worldly, brash street kid. A big part of her shtick, which she uses as a trademark, is referring to herself as petite flower, fashion plate, and goddess. Tenuta has a pretty dimpled face, but she mostly obscures her attractiveness with scowls and grimaces, and there are those corny dresses and the blossoms she wears in her hair. The ironic epithets, which are meant to underscore her toughness and control, backfire. She comes off denigrating herself. There's little difference between Tenuta's self-sabotage and the bites Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers take out of their own hides. Tenuta's uncertainty points up a problem shared by most women stand-ups, especially those who traffic in her kind of rawness, which immediately lays a woman open to the charge that she's not womanly, not sexually kosher. Despite claims to the contrary, the stand-up stage is still treated like a male preserve, a locker room, a bullring, which women invade. Tenuta's persona says, in effect, You're going to get me for trespassing, so I'll kick myself first. Actress comics such as Lily Tomlin, Anne Magnuson, and Whoopi Goldberg have an easier time being unapologetically defiant because they have repertoires of characters and stalk theater stages where women have had a long history. Among well-honed, talented women stand-up comics, only Sandra Bernhardt sasses without taking it back, but anyone who's watched her arouse David Letterman's viciousness knows how perilous the course can be. She recently imagined him dangling over her, like a boom mic. In response, he stared into the camera like a pit bull and spat, "Not if you were the last woman on Earth." Bernhardt didn't quail, but neither did she tell him to screw off. She's too much the bourgeois pragmatist to risk banishment from his show. Rough-hewn Tenuta has the mettle to chew up and spit out the likes of Letterman, but how much more effective she would be if she did it as a woman rather than a petite flower.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at our next show. Terry Gross will be back on the next Fresh Air, and she'll speak with the singer Dion. As leader of the 60s group Dion and the Belmonts, he gave us hits like Runaround Sue and The Wanderer. In recent years, he's turned toward Christian music. Jazz critic Francis Davis will review a new album by the composer and clarinetist John Carter, and television critic David Bianculli will review a new cable variety show called Showtime Coast to Coast. So I hope you'll be able to listen. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, with additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. All of the above people have made my 2 weeks on Fresh Air most enjoyable. I'm going back to New York, and Terry Gross is coming back from the beach, so I hope you'll be here for the next Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.